check to see who's on the telephone with us this morning. Colleen Savold?
Yes, I'm here, Mr. Chairman.
Tammy Chrisman?
Present, Mr. Chairman.
Melanie Accord and Deb Kusunis?
Present, Melanie Accord only. Debbie Kusunis could not make it today.
Thank you. Marlene Bennett?
Present, Mr. Chairman.
Melissa Thompson?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I'm here.
Ron Spangler? Someone might turn the, thank you. Ron Spangler?
Here, Mr. Chairman. I also have Rick Johnson and Wayne Mueller with me.
Thank you. Doug Idol? Is Doug with us this morning? Jeff Decker?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Jim Wilcox?
Here, Mr. Chairman.
Kevin Kuba?
Here, Mr. Chairman.
Pamela Harrington? Pamela, are you with us this morning? Linda Walsh?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm here. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning to everyone. This is the South Dakota Public Utility Commission meeting for Thursday, July 28th, 9:30 a.m., the year 2005. We're in the State Capitol Building, room 412 in Pierce, South Dakota. I am Commissioner Gary Hansen, and with me today are Commissioners Bob Saar and Dusty Johnson. The first item on our agenda is approval of the minutes. Is there a motion to approve the minutes of June 28th?
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Seconded.
Thank you, and I concur. Consumer issues, Deb Gregg.
Thank you, Chairman Hansen. The Commission has received a total of 1,010 consumer contacts during 2005. 99 of these contacts have been received since the last report was prepared for the July 12, 2005 Commission meeting. 43 of the contacts for this period involve telecommunication services. 17 of the contacts involve electrical services. 9 contacts involved natural gas services. And 3 contacts involved gas and electric services. 12 contacts involved cellular phone service. 3 contacts were related to the Do Not Call registry. And 12 contacts involved miscellaneous items not regulated by the PUC. 831 of the 1,010 complaints received in 2005 have been resolved, and 2,126 of the 2,370 contacts received in 2004 have been resolved.
Thank you, Deb. The second item on our agenda is CT05-004 in the matter of the complaint filed by Eldon Lindquist on behalf of Peer Radio Paging and Telephone of Pierce, South Dakota, against Venture Communications Cooperative, Incorporated of Sully Butte's Telephone Cooperative, Inc., regarding a billing dispute. And the question before the commission today is, shall the commission grant the motion? We will first hear arguments from, from the Pierce Radio Paging and Telephone. No? Oh, you made the motion. That's right. The complainant is... thank you.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. This is Randy Odak from Venture. I'm also have called in.
Thank you, Randy, for letting us know. You're represented here this morning by Bob Ritter and Ritter Ryder.
You do tend to mix it up. It's Ryder.
Bob. That's why I call you Bob.
I don't blame you. Hansen is easier to pronounce than Ryder, obviously.
Unless it's a particular Hanson or Hansen, right? Thank you, Bob.
You bet. Mr. Chair and members of the Commission, I'm appearing today as a member of Ryder, Rogers, Wadier, and Brown. Darla Rogers is otherwise involved in other matters, and so she has asked me to appear today on behalf of Venture Communications, and as Randy Hodak indicated, he is by phone appearing on behalf of Venture Communications as well. The motion that's been submitted is very straightforward. We have asked that this matter be dismissed, principally asked that it be dismissed because the claim that's being asserted by Mr. Lindquist and his company involves the interpretation of federal law, more particularly a federal decision. And the statute in South Dakota, which gives authority to this commission over carriers, indicates that the jurisdiction applies to issues not otherwise regulated by federal law or regulation and involves, in effect, the concerns and issues regarding the laws of this state. But in this particular case, what we've got before the commission, or what Mr. Lindquist has brought before the commission, is a question involving not what he was charged, not what the tariff rates are, but rather, and whether he was charged pursuant to our tariff rates, but rather whether a decision from the FCC makes a change required in the rates. And we argue that this is a decision that ought to more properly be brought to, if he wants to pursue it, before the FCC. It is not a decision that involves issues specific to the state of South Dakota, and it does not involve interpretation of our state law or your regulations or statutes governing utilities that operate in South Dakota. So we believe that the jurisdiction of the PUC in this matter does not exist. It's not a billing dispute, too, and he alleges in his complaint that it is a billing dispute. We think that it is not a billing dispute, but rather it is an allegation that the rate charged was in excess of the tariff rate. And the only reason it would become in excess of the tariff rate, according to his argument, is if the decision of the FCC requires an interpretation that it is in excess of the tariff rate, because we did not charge in excess of the tariff rate. And so it all boils around, or it all revolves around, more particularly, the decision from the FCC in the case that we cited in our motion to dismiss. Lastly, as far as the jurisdictional issue, 49-31-5.1 confirms that the PUC would not have jurisdiction over Venture's local rates. They are filed, as I understand it, for informational purposes, and they are kept at the offices in Highmore, where Mr. Hodak is located, and reflect the rates as they exist over there. The second part of our motion is a motion to strike. And the reason we brought the motion to strike is Mr. Lindquist's complaint includes as attachments many different communications by and between the parties. And some of the communications involve efforts by the parties to resolve this matter, and more particularly efforts by Venture to resolve this matter so it would not have to come before the FCC or perhaps before this PUC, as he has attempted to now pursue. The law in South Dakota, and particularly the statute, says that evidence of efforts to compromise or attempt to compromise a claim are not admissible. That's SECL 19-12-10. Mr. Lindquist has not only sought to make them admissible, but he has submitted them before you as part of his attachments on his complaint, and they are not admissible. A case law in South Dakota is very clear that those should not be admissible, because they then interfere with efforts of the parties to try to resolve the matters in an amicable way, so they do not have to come before either you or the tribunal in their, if it's a case before the court. So clearly, much of the items and many of the items attached to his complaint are, in effect, not admissible and should not be on the complaint and should be stricken from the complaint. Interestingly enough, however, one of the attachments attached to his complaint is a letter from a lawyer in Washington, D.C., on his behalf to my partner, Ms. Rogers, dated March 12, 2001. And the last paragraph of that letter says that we are, Pure Radio is, and I'm paraphrasing, but Pure Radio is prepared to press our request for resolution of this matter at the Federal Communications Commission. This letter serves as our notice of our intent to bring a formal complaint before the agency if the instant matter is not resolved in a timely manner. I mention that only because I think even their own correspondence from counsel in Washington, D.C. on their behalf reflect the fact that complainant understands, or at least his counsel in D.C. understood, that if this matter were to be brought forward for resolution, that an appropriate jurisdiction for it is before the FCC and not before this commission. Accordingly, we would ask that this matter be dismissed.
Thank you, Mr. Ryder. Are there any questions at this juncture? John?
And maybe it's better if I wait till the end here. I did have a couple of questions, I think. Would you, is it your position that this dispute is an inter-carrier dispute? Was Mr. Lindquist's company working as a telecommunications carrier at the time, as opposed to a consumer of your services at retail?
If I might respond, and I will attempt to answer that question. He was a radio paging, had a radio paging company. I understand that he has attempted to submit his claim as a radio paging company. Now, certainly, I don't know that he would be a regulated utility. If that's the question, I don't know the answer to that, and maybe you're better served to ask him. Unfortunately, I just don't know that I can answer that directly.
Well, I think the reason I'm asking it is just with respect to the issue of Section 5.1 of Chapter 31 and the issue regarding your tariffed retail rates and whether or not, you know, if this is an intercarrier claim, then that particular defense may not be applicable here, and that was my reason for asking that.
And well, I think I've effectively not answered your question, so I...
Well, and ultimately, I think, you know, that's for... part of that is going to rest on him and what he was doing, and it's not completely clear from the complaint what this is all about, you know. I think one of the troublesome things, or I think for us looking at this from a jurisdiction standpoint, is at least I've done some research on this, and I can't find a case anywhere that seems to be to hold that a state commission is preempted in a situation like this from hearing a intercarrier case involving a CMRS provider. And I at least I can't find one. So that puts us, if there isn't one out there, then that puts us in the tough position of having to go out on our own and make a preemption finding, you know, without any kind of federal court case or FCC decision or express statutory preemption language.
If I might reply, I think the statute under which this PUC does his operations or handles its matters reflects that in a situation like this where it involves something that is regulated by federal law and regulation, and clearly it is in this case because you've got a decision from the FCC that is the basis for Mr. Lindquist's claim before the commission. And it doesn't involve the billing. It doesn't involve him having been billed in excess of tariff rates or something that would be more specific to the state of South Dakota, but rather it involved his belief that the interpretation that the FCC has given any case impacts the charges that he has received or that his company has received. And it seems to me that everything clearly revolves around federal law and that it, under 49-31-3, that this is a matter that is regulated by federal law. And as I've indicated, I think that the his own statement of his counsel in the letter that I cited or referenced reflects the knowledge and intent that this is a matter that is, if appropriate to be brought, before the FCC as opposed to this commission.
Just with respect to his settlement letters, and I don't think there's any dispute that settlement negotiations are not going to be evidence in this case unless they're relevant for some purpose that isn't apparent yet. Might those letters, I mean, if we're just looking at this from Eldon having filed this without, at the time, without legal counsel on his own behalf, might we not view those letters as merely his way of, without having had to try to ferret out everything that's in the letters, the exchanges, and put them into a complaint in his words, have just attached those so that to give the commission an idea of what this is all about?
Well, and I appreciate that might well have been his intent. I would say, however, that Exhibit 1, that is his, as opposed to attachment of correspondence, is his actual statement of the basis for his complaint, references the same things. I mean, he's drawn out from those letters the communications that we've had between our company and Mr. Lindquist's company relative to these issues. So I mean, I think it invades more than just a couple of attachments.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any further questions at this time? If not, we will hear from Eldon Lindquist's representative, or Eldon. Good morning.
Good morning. Tom Maher, Sr., appearing with Eldon. I haven't been involved in this until today, but Eldon asked me to come along, and I'll do it. It seems to me that we may have hit, you know, basically the crux of this. Eldon should be able to go to a South Dakota company from which he's buying services and get his billing records and try and settle a billing dispute. And what he's saying to you is that he has tried to do that. He's asked for these billing records many times. He's asked for them from the company. He's asked from their attorneys. He's had me ask their attorneys for these billing records, and they haven't been provided. So to me, you're being told there's nothing you can do about it, that you have no jurisdiction to hear his complaint of a South Dakota citizen who does business here in Pierre against a company that's up here in Oneida. This should be the kind of thing that you set down across the desk and resolve. It shouldn't be something that we have to involve the commission and attorneys to get how much he was overbilled. It's clear he was overbilled a lot of money, okay, and it's clear they have never given him records on it. Now, you're being told that because there's a FCC regulation, a ruling that affects these charges, that that is the only remedy that anybody in the whole United States can seek to deal with this. And I don't believe that is the case at all. It doesn't meet the common sense guideline that everyone in the whole United States who's been overbilled by one of these people would have to go to Washington to have it resolved. And what they've simply done is they've said, you are using an unfair procedure here in billing across the board. This was going on across the board, just like you would say, hey, you've been making these radial tires, and the bands in them are bad, and you're going to have to recall some, and you're going to have to replace some. That doesn't mean that every consumer of that tire has to go into Washington, D.C. and sue to get their tire fixed. They can sue Goodyear, or if they bought it from a reputable dealer that's still in business, right here in Pierre. And so when they're saying there is a remedy in Washington, that doesn't mean it's the only remedy. And what we really have is a billing dispute that has been ongoing, that has, frankly, that other providers were doing also. Quest was doing it. They stepped up to the plate. They gave Eldon the total of what they'd overbilled, and he's reached a settlement with them. He's resolved it with them. They did it in a businesslike way. Now, I think that all he's asking is for a little help to get their attention and make them at least give him the billing records and admit how much they overbilled and when they stopped. They're saying statute of limitations. I mean, what date did they stop billing him improperly? They haven't provided it. It's kind of like asking, you know, when did you stop beating your dog? I mean, we don't know, okay? And typically this would happen that Eldon should be able to go in and talk to Mr. Hodak in Oneida, and they should calculate up what he was overbilled, and they should say, well, since you've been a little bit late, we're going to adjust your rates in the future, or we're going to give you this much credit, or we're going to resolve this in this manner. That hasn't happened here, and I don't think there's been any business-like approach to settling this. There's been what I would call delay, no answer, no information, and then after some time has run, hey, you're too late, statute of limitations. That's basically what I think. Or you got to go to Washington. So on, and I don't practice in front of the PUC all the time, but I did read their brief, and they say that you have no jurisdiction because of 4931.5.1, and they say that that exempts you from having any authority under 4931.3. But first, 4931.5.1 does not exempt them from 4931.3. It exempts from 4931.3.1 through 4.1. It's very specific. It does not tear out the section that says that you have the right to inquire into any complaints, any neglect, and you have the right to exercise powers necessary to properly supervise and control such companies. So that statute that I say gives you the right to hear a complaint, such as we say this is a billing complaint, is not exempted under the statute that they cited. Secondly, the party making a motion has the burden of proof, and I don't believe they've presented to you any dates, any records that show when they stopped this billing, because they haven't even given us how they were misbilling. So therefore, that's the earliest date that the statute of limitations would arguably start to run, and they haven't offered it to you, nor us. If they would do that, this could be resolved, I think, just the way it was resolved with Quest. Go ahead.
Thank you. First of all, I'll go through this first. For 40 years, I've done business with Venture and Sully Buttes, both as a customer and as a provider of services to them for their equipment. And this is the only matter that I have not been able to come before them and discuss this in a reasonable manner. I have gone to Randy Hodeck several times, and I'm always referred to legal counsel, and it just gets bogged down from there. This matter is really about the Telecom Act of 96, where the FCC rearranged everything as far as some of these regulations is concerned. And this was a matter of changing their billing practices effective with the 1996 Telecom Act, and this was not brought out and mandated by the FCC until the year 2000. So here we had 4 years that nobody knew what was going to happen. Of course, it was appealed, and so we attempted to get this resolved, and it was just virtually stonewalled at every angle. The only time that I got any type of response was to come to the PUC staff and ask for some help on trying to bring them to the table to at least discuss this. And even at the latest, it was... at that time, they did respond that there was some responsibility and did make an offer to settle this. However, it was done with no idea of what the past billing records were, and any attempt for us to, you know, and I just calculated the best I could what I thought it should be. And, of course, like Tom said, he tried to resolve this. They insisted on not talking and coming to the commission, bringing this motion to the commission. So I think this is just a matter of principle and what is right. We did everything that we could in our on our behalf to try and bring this to some reasonable conclusion. And, you know, it just did not happen. Now, to answer your question about a possibility of being an inter-carrier exchange problem, I believe that there is. However, there's been some deregulation in that manner, and I don't know what the timing has been on some of that either. I just don't know.
Just with respect to that, Eldon, I mean, these bills we're talking about are billings between your paging company.
Yes,
and
yes, definitely. This
that
is
not you as Eldon Lindquist.
No, not as an
person.
Individual.
Okay, these aren't personal phone calls.
No.
And are these bills right now, do you still own and operate the paging company?
I'm still involved in the business, yes. I'm still majority stockholder.
And just with reference to the, and this is one that, you know, I don't know the answer to, but with reference to one of the statute of limitations statutes that we have, and that's 15-2-4 is my recollection, and I know I'm putting you on the spot and you won't be able to answer it maybe, but that deals with a statute of limitations that governs open accounts. And what I'm getting at, I guess, is whether this might be a case that falls under that open account statute, and I don't know the answer to that. Maybe counsel could get back to us with some perspective as to whether that might be involved here. I mean, it hits me that I haven't at least been able to find a case right on point as to exactly how you figure out what the statute of limitations when it's told in a case like this, and it might be useful for us to have your attorney and Mr. Ryder to give us some guidance as to what we would look to. And again, I'm assuming that the FCC's statute of limitations does not apply to us with that question. I'm not deciding it. I'm just assuming it for purpose of that question.
I have one other comment on this as far as that FCC. And when this ruling came down, the billing of these services dropped very dramatically, probably as much as 50%. So we're looking at over 4 years of billing of what, you know, the possible overbilling losses from the November of 96 until whatever it was. And, well, we don't know when they changed their billing.
Were these least, billings? Oh, excuse me.
It was, you know, at least we can't determine when that was because I don't have access to the billing.
Is this particular claim right now still, for lack of a better term, owned by the paging company? Is the paging company a corporation?
I'm sorry, is that?
The paging company? Is your paging company
yes.
a corporation?
Yes.
Are these... is this claim, is this a claim that is still owned by the paging company against Venture, or has this claim been assigned to you as a person?
It is set aside because of a purchase agreement that I have the party that is purchasing did not want to be involved in this, so I took it on as a separate item. However, I'm still the majority stockholder. Therefore, I own, you know, I own them both, so to speak.
But these are right now, and again, without a document. But I guess what I'm trying to get at, and some of this relates to our statutes involving the necessity for you to have legal counsel. And again, I'm not trying to oust Mr. Maher here, and it's useful to have a lawyer involved. I'll tell you that, but. My reason for asking is, the only reason I bring it up is, if you can demonstrate that these are now claims of you as a human being as opposed to if you are the plaintiff as a person as opposed to a corporation, it may be possible for you to appear here without legal counsel. And that's the only reason I'm bringing it up.
Any of this matter would be still handled within the corporation.
Okay.
And you know, any charges in it or any reimbursements and anything would still be handled under the corporate entity.
Thank you. Then you do need legal counsel.
Well, Eldon does a pretty good job. He knows far more about this than I do. But I think you did hit on one thing, and Eldon discussed it. When I still call it Sully Buttes. When Sully Buttes makes a little settlement offer, and Eldon is sitting in my office, he comes in, he wants to know what to do. And I say, what relationship does it bear to how much they overbilled you? And he doesn't know. They haven't given records. So I say to Darla Rogers, we'll consider your proposal, but I need the billing records. I need to know how much he was overbilled. That's back in April or May. Okay, I'll get that. We'll get that to you. Okay. As I sit here today, I've got nothing. Okay. We can't judge if the proposal, and that's why, is there making efforts to resolve it? No, that's not making an effort to resolve it. That's take it or leave it.
So would then one of the objectives of continuing the proceeding be to avail yourself of the commission's discovery procedures?
Yes.
Thank you.
Are there any further questions of Tom or Eldon?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Mr. Maher, Mr. Lindquist. You both have addressed the motion to dismiss, but not really the motion to strike. Do you have any comment or opposition to that motion?
This is on the settlement papers and the argument. Some of those, there are parts that relate to settlement and they're not admissible. But there are other parts that relate to notices to Sully Buttes that, hey, we have been overbilled. We'd like the records. There are parts of it, I think, that are admissible and parts that aren't. And the commission would kind of set in the position of the court, and I think disregard the parts that would be related to let's settle this from the parts of we need the records.
Thank you.
Further questions?
So it would be your position that if the proceeding went forward that we could handle it at or nearby the hearing, and basically since the evidentiary issues, just take what is evidence and then take out what is not appropriate for evidence.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Seeing no further questions of Tom or Eldon, thank you very much. Randy, at the beginning of the conversation, you stated you were on the line. You're represented by capable legal staff here. Do you want to make a statement, or Mr. Hoda?
Yeah, I'm here. Mr. Ryder is doing a fine job, so I won't step in front of him. However, I will say that some of the statements made on behalf of Mr. Lindquist and his counsel were not accurate, and there have been several attempts to try to resolve this, not because we thought we did anything wrong, but to avoid this process and the involvement of legal counsel and just to make it go away. I can't speak for Quest, but I suspect that's probably why theirs has been resolved, not because they felt they did something wrong, but just to avoid a legal and regulatory fight. Other than that, we will I'll let Mr. Ryder handle it for us.
Thank you, Mr. Hodak. John has either a statement or a question.
Well, I just want to observe here that we're not trying the case today. This is just a motion to dismiss and a motion to strike. So in terms of the factual dispute over who said what and who did what when, that's for the hearing. Okay, today we're just dealing with the motion, but thank you, Randy and Eldon.
Exactly. That's why I didn't ask Randy for specifics just now. It sounds as if there's an opportunity for folks to get together and have some discussion here, notwithstanding the motion to dismiss and strike.
Do I have just a minute?
Certainly, Mr. Ryder.
I appreciate Mr. Smith's comment, but I can't let some of that go unanswered. there's correspondence in the file from the year 2000 where Darla Rogers, on behalf of Venture, was communicating with counsel for Mr. Lindquist and his company. So I don't want the commission to be left with the innuendo that somehow Venture and or Darla Rogers were not responsive to trying to tell Pure Radio Paging what we believe the law is and how it applies in this particular case. We have been consistent in our belief and position that this is a matter for the FCC, if it is a matter for anyone. And so we've let them know that throughout, and I don't want that suggestion to go unanswered. A couple other things more to the merits of this, you know, as the commission knows, what some other carrier did or didn't do doesn't relate to the issues before you as far as whether or not there's jurisdiction. And so the statements made relative to that, frankly, are of little significance to the issues presented to you today. And I appreciate Mr. Smith's comment in his question on the statute of limitations, that you are presupposing that the federal statute of 2 years would not be applicable and that we should look at the state statute. Our belief and argument still would be that the federal statute is the appropriate one to look at. But back to the real merits of the motion, and the issue presented relates to a decision made by the Federal Communications Commission in June of 2000. And Mr. Lindquist is right. It relates to the 1996 Telecommunications Act. So it is an interpretation by a federal body of a federal act that he is seeking to say, because of that, I'm entitled to a different charge. Not because of the tariff rates. He's not claiming he was overbilled. He's just claiming that if you would look at this federal law and if you would look at this federal decision, then you would find that there is an inappropriate charge in this case. I mean, I think, and I would argue, that the basis that he brings before you is clearly a federal law, it's a federal decision, and it ought to be resolved if he is dissatisfied with the resolution of it and dissatisfied with our responses and our argument to him, that it ought to be resolved by the Federal Communications Commission. And Mr. Mulhar argued that this is like, why does he have to go to Washington? Well, he didn't file any complaint with someone that complained in circuit court. He didn't seek to do that. The statute in South Dakota specifically provides that the Public Utilities Commission controls telecommunications companies, not within the state, to the extent such business is not otherwise regulated by federal law or regulation. Our argument is that this particular segment of the business is clearly regulated by the Federal Communications Act of 1996 that he submits his basis upon, his claim upon, rather, and then also by that decision in the year 2000. And another, just on the statute of limitations issue, it seems terribly difficult for any telecommunications company to be faced with a decision at some time in the future, the year 2000, and say, we're going to look back for 10 years or 15 years, and we're going to modify all these charges that have been made through all these years, or even if you want to go and open account if it's six years. That's why the FCC's got the 2-year statute of limitations, too, because there has to be some finality. There cannot be an open book forever and ever and ever. So that's my argument.
Mr. Ryder, your argument that it is not in the jurisdiction of the PUC, does that also, with Mr. Maher's statement that it does not apply to your argument to 49.31.3, do you believe your argument applies to both?
If I might, Mr. Chair.
Please.
49.31.3, and I forgot to bring my book back up here with me, but that statute is the one that really sets out the jurisdiction of the Public Utilities Commission. 5.1 talks about the fact that carriers such as Venture are not regulated under that statute, and Mr. Maher is correct that it does not specifically reference 49.31-3. But I think that that is the statute that it appears that it grants the broad authority that the commission does have, subject to these certain limitations.
Thank you. John?
What about the interplay between 4913 and 49? I think that's something the commission that we've struggled with a lot here, is the way in which those particular things interconnect, not to use a telecom term in my question. I want to note, too, Bob, I'm not presupposing that that the state statute of limitations applies. I was just assuming it for purposes of asking the question.
And I took it that way, and if my comments were to the contrary, I took it that way, that that was just another issue that we needed to present. I haven't, as part of my preparation for this morning, specifically looked at the interplay between 4931 and 49-13. Clearly, 4913 does grant private citizens the ability to bring issues before the commission. And clearly, there are claims that can be asserted. In this particular case, I think, as you pointed out in your questions, and Mr. Lindquist didn't answer that question a lot better than I did, but he's got more knowledge of the business than I do as far as the paging companies. But if they are a regulated utility, certainly that would be, we would argue, you would look at 4931 relative to issues of that nature.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I have a couple. Mr. Ryder, I'm just trying to make sure in the course of the conversation I haven't lost your arguments here. Is yours on the jurisdiction or lack thereof, is yours based more on the subject matter involved or the determination of whether or not they are a common carrier or provider or a consumer type complaint or something else?
If I might, Commissioner Saar, my argument would be that these are federal issues regulated by the Federal Communications Commission and involve interpretations from the commission. It is not a consumer billing dispute because there's no claims that it's anything other than a claim by Mr. Lindquist and his company that the rate could not be charged to it pursuant to the Federal Communications Rules and Regulations.
And if we did deny the motion to dismiss, are you of the opinion that the evidentiary question of whether or not to strike and what to strike, since it would be obviously not going to hearing until sometime in the future, if that couldn't get resolved, or certainly we could give you the option to re-raise that motion as opposed to going and trying to figure out what to strike or not to strike today? I mean, to me, certainly, I know your big issue is the motion to dismiss. I don't want to lose the ball here, but or lose force for the trees. But the question I would have is with the motion to strike, I mean, it almost seems like something where I think you have a valid point on certainly a lot of things in there. Would you be willing to sit down if we denied the motion to Smith and work with Mr. Lindquist and his counsel and just be able to clean that up and figure it out in that regard and or else just wait till hearing on that issue?
Well, Commissioner, when Ms. Rogers and I discussed this when we were filing this pleading, we need to present to the commission the fact that there are allegations that are not properly presented and that the motion to strike seemed to us to be the most appropriate approach to resolving that issue. Now, I appreciate the fact that part of the difficulty is that you act as the judge that resolves the motions and also as the jury that decides the facts. And so once it's there, once it's presented, and then it's more difficult, I suppose, to try to iron that out. But, I mean, I think obviously courts do it all the time where they will strike certain portions of the pleadings and there's nothing said that counsel could not sit down and determine the parts that should be stricken and the parts that clearly are not necessarily handled in that area.
Well, and I appreciate you raising the issue, and I think if I were in your shoes, I probably would have as well. But the one of the challenges, well, first of all, I know I'm stating the obvious to you, but just because something's in a pleading or an allegation doesn't mean it's evidence. Second thing is, without some sort of supporting affidavit, direction, agreement amongst the party, I mean, I think maybe some of it on its face we could say absolutely settlement. Some of it might start getting a little ambiguous. I'm just saying strictly from my standpoint, saying today what shall be stricken, what shall not be. I don't know if I have the proper set of information in front of me, and I think it's something that in 15 minutes in the hallway attorneys can hash out and bring to us. And I'm not criticizing what you've done. I think it's just been fine, but I'm just saying it may be something that is better resolved between the parties. And certainly if I were to deny that part of it, it certainly would be with the anticipation that it would be an issue going forward, and certainly with the acknowledgement that I think it's a very appropriate issue to raise up, but I think probably something can be cleaned up a little bit later on. I'm just worried about striking something at this point in time that later on could be turned out to be pertinent, and I know we can correct that, but it seems like that's a little bit more difficult to go that route.
And Commissioner, I appreciate that. I know our motion was very broad, our motion to strike. We didn't specifically reference sentences or paragraphs, and so we referenced Exhibit 1 and all of the attachments, and that's very broad. And clearly some of those communications, there's an argument made that they don't specifically relate to settlement, and so I appreciate what you're saying. We can work on that.
Thank you.
Are there any further questions? If not, it appears that all the parties are in agreement that some of the items on the complaint, some of the attachments, should not be included. I think we will, unless someone is compelled to make a motion. Excuse me? Well, I think staff is in disagreement. Sarah.
No, thank you, Chairman Hansen. Staff would just echo some of the comments already made, one by Mr. Smith. Yes, it is clear that the FCC has given itself jurisdiction in this matter. However, it has not given itself exclusive jurisdiction and has not preempted state commissions from taking anything up. We are dealing with intrastate traffic, and I would see no reason why the commission should be precluded from hearing this matter. On the issue of striking the settlement negotiations, staff would recommend one of two things, either having the parties work out some sort of blacking out of the settlement discussions within the agreements, or simply taking the documents out of the complaint right now, and then in the future, if needed, they can be admitted for limited purposes. Should they be needed for a statute of limitations argument or something in the future, they could be admitted for those limited purposes in the future would be our suggestions.
Thank you, Ms. Griff. Well said. Unless someone is compelled to make a motion, it would appear that we should defer this to a future meeting and allow parties to work out some of those challenges. Electricity, item 1, is EL04-016 in the matter of the filing by Superior Renewable Energy, LLC, against Montana Dakota Utilities regarding the Java Wind Project. Today, the question before the commission is, shall it the commission grant the motion for continuance. And the request for the continuance was by Superior, and we have Superior on the telephone. Ms. Walsh.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Linda Walsh from Hunton Williams in Washington, D.C. Mr. Meyer-Henry wasn't available today, so I'm filling in. We filed a motion for continuance of the hearing. Parties are still engaging in settlement discussions, and we would like a little bit more time.
Thank you. Are there any?
As far as I'm aware, there's no objection to the motion.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak to this matter? Anyone from MDU who wishes to address this? If not, are there any questions by the commission? Is there a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move that the Commission grant the motion for continuance.
And I second.
And I concur. Item 2 is EL05-020 in the matter of the joint request for an electric service rights exception between Northwestern Corporation doing business as Northwestern Energy and Douglas Electric Cooperative Incorporated. The question before the Commission is, shall the Commission approve the joint request for an electric service rights exception? And is Northwestern represented?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this is Jeff Decker. I'd just simply like to state that all parties are in agreement and Northwestern is in support of this.
Thank you. Is there anyone from Douglas Electric who wishes to address the Commission? Is there anyone on Commission staff who wishes to address?
Thank you, Chairman Hansen. This is Michelle Ferris with staff. Both Northwestern Energy and Douglas Electric Cooperative filed a joint request for an electric service territory exception. Mr. Kelvin Beyer is constructing a new home, and the home is located in Douglas's service territory. However, the nearest facilities that Douglas has are about a mile and a half away, which would cause some cost to the consumer for the aid to construction. And they're requesting that Northwestern be allowed to serve them because they have facilities that are closer to the home. I have received a letter from Mr. Beyer that he has made this request and is aware of the change. And all parties agree that this would be in the best interest for the consumer as well as promote the efficient and economical use of the electric facilities in the area. And staff would recommend that the Commission approve this service rights exception.
Thank you, Michelle. Any questions? Is there a motion? I move that the Commission approve the joint request for an electric service rights exception.
And I second.
Concur.
Michelle, I fear that I failed to call on you on the last item. Is that correct? When everyone was in agreement on Superior.
No, that would have been Karen.
All right. My apologies to you, Karen. EL05-021 in the matter of the filing for approval of an exception to service on assigned areas between Central Electric Cooperative, Inc. and XL Energy. Question before the Commission is, shall the Commission approve the exception to service on assigned areas?
Mr. Chairman, Jim Wilcox from XL Energy here. This item is very similar to the previous agenda item. XL Energy and Central have come to agreement on an exception to a service to a small business near Emory, South Dakota, and we would respectfully request approval.
Thank you, Mr. Wilcox. Is there anyone from Central Electric who wishes to comment on this item? If not, Michelle?
Thank you. Again, as Jim had said, this is very similar to the previous request. I did receive a letter from Paul Stahl. He would be the proprietor of Paul's Precision Parts. They're requesting three-phase service for a small commercial structure that they're building near Emory. And the nearest three-phase service that Central has is approximately 2.5 miles away, which would result in the customer paying for aid to construction. And XL has facilities that are closer to the structure, and all parties are in agreement that this is in the best interest for the consumer as well as promotes the efficient and economical use of the respective systems. Staff would recommend that the Commission approve the service rights exception.
Thank you, Ms. Ferris. Are there any questions? Item 3, is there a motion? I move that the Commission approve the exception to service on assigned areas.
And I second.
Concur.
Natural gas, NG05-005, in the matter of the filing by MidAmerican Energy Company for approval of tariff revisions. Question before the Commission is, shall the Commission approve the tariff revisions? Is there someone from MidAmerica?
Yes, Mr. Commissioner. This is Melanie Acord with MidAmerican Energy Company. MidAmerican is seeking approval of its interruptible monthly metered transportation gas pilot project tariff, otherwise known as IMT. This is a new optional service offering for schools and governmental entities that have the capability to either switch to an alternate fuel, such as LP or fuel oil, or to discontinue natural gas usage for a minimum of 24 hours. This offering is similar to the MMT tariff, which is monthly metered transportation gas pilot tariff offering approved by the commission in November of 2004. The difference is one of making modifications of allowing interruptible versus firm supply. Just to give you some background on the genesis of this tariff, in docket number NG02-003, the commission ordered MidAmerican to file a plan to eliminate interruptible rates by June 26, 2004, citing, one, firm customer subsidization of interruptible customers in the PTA, two, administrative burden in notifying customers of the interruptions, and three, difficulty in verifying compliance during interruption. Between the Commission's order in 2002 and MidAmerican Energy's 2004 plan filing to eliminate interruptible rates, MidAmerican listened to customer concerns regarding elimination of interruptible service and developed a plan to balance the issues of subsidization, administration, and program compliance against the needs of the customers to use interruptible rates to manage their energy costs. One aspect of the 2004 plan was to offer schools and governmental entities an alternative to interruptible service, and that's the Monthly Metered Transportation Gas Pilot Project, or MMT. This pilot is designed to give participants an opportunity to transport natural gas without having to make daily nominations and daily balancing. The MMT is currently limited to firm supply. Since approval of the MMT, questions raised by a pool operator caused MidAmerican Energy to consider a tariff that would provide interruptible supply options for monthly metered transportation customers. MidAmerican will continue to provide firm delivery of customer-owned gas under this tariff offering. However, the pool operator will be able to purchase and transport interruptible supply to its customers that are capable of discontinuing their gas use. The key differences between the proposed interruptible monthly metered transportation gas pilot project tariff and the existing MMT tariff are, one, pool operators will have the authority to call a supply interruption for their pool. Two, pool operators will be responsible for administering any interruption, and this will include notifying customers of the interruption. Three, interruptions will be for the entire gas day and for the entire pool. Four, pool operators will be responsible for notifying MidAmerican of the supply interruption via MidAmerican's electronic bulletin board. And five, daily metering will be required to ensure compliance with interruptions. Pool operators will be billed for penalties and gas used by its customers during supply interruptions. MidAmerican considers this tariff service to be another tool available for schools and governmental entities to use as a means of controlling energy costs while addressing the issues outlined in Commission's order in docket number NG02-003 on interruptible service. That's all I have.
Thank you very much. Is there, let's see, Dave?
Yes, thank you, Chairman. Since the initial filing was made, there are several changes that have been discussed by staff and the company and which have been agreed to. Most of them are word clarifications. One significant addition is the addition of an applicability and availability section to the beginning of tariff, which to potential customers clearly spells out the terms and conditions of the tariff and eligibility requirements. Since the tariff was filed, after discussions with the company, they have proposed to adjust the administrative charge, which also exists in the existing firm tariff. Those charges, there's two charges like that. There's an administrative charge and a swing service charge. And in the existing tariff, there's language that calls for an annual update because these are new programs and pilot programs with a definitive ending period, there is an ability for the company to update these administrative charges annually until the pilot program ends. And so as to, because those costs are basically unknown going into a pilot, we want to make sure that the costs incurred are recovered by the cost causers in this case. And they have elected to update the administrative charge. There were additional IT expenses that were not foreseen, and those are one-time startup type of costs. So that did increase. I would expect that in the future there will be a filing to similarly increase that same charge for the existing firm rate. Other than those changes from the original filing, I think Melanie has provided an explanation of where this has evolved from. If you have any further questions in that regard, I'd be happy to answer that. Other than that, staff would recommend approval of the TARE.
Thank you very much, Dave. Are there any questions? Is there a motion?
I do have a couple of questions, Mr. Chairman. I just want to make sure I've got this right. It is a monthly metered transportation. And yet so the nominations are done on a monthly basis. But the daily metering is just to ensure that there's no product usage on those days of service interruption?
That's right.
Okay. What could either you or the Ms. Accord kind of walk me through what are the different benefits and incentives? I mean, why does this fit for one type of consumer rather than another? I mean, why would somebody sign up for the interruptible service?
There'd be Melanie could take crack at it, but I can try too. Basically, there are a couple of reasons why customers would like interruptible service. Number one, if they have facilities in place that allow them to switch to a different alternative source of heating, in this case, this is what this is applicable for.
And these would be on days where the price of natural gas was high enough that their alternative fuel would make more economic sense? Or?
It could, yes. Another reason why they would like, that's probably the primary reason because these would be short-term interruptions. Another reason why for longer periods of time that people like, customers like interruptible services, that there are advantages in pipeline rates that can be taken advantage of. Those are generally over a longer period of time. So I would, and because this is all administered through a pool operator, the pool operator is lining up these supplies and making these decisions, and so that's where the request actually comes from, as far as I understand. So, but it is both supply. It could relate back to pipeline charges, but I think it's probably more on the supply side of opportunities that become available.
And I concur with those reasons.
So the real incentive comes through potential savings in contracts with the pipeline.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. That's all I have. Thank you.
Any further questions? If not, is there a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move that the Commission approve the tariff revisions.
I will second.
And I concur.
Under telecommunications, we have TC05-052, and we have an addendum on a motion that was made in the matter of the application of New Rochelle Telephone Corp. for a certificate of authority to provide inter-exchange telecommunications services and local exchange services in South Dakota. On our addendum under telecommunications, New Rochelle has filed a request to withdraw its application. The question is, shall the commission grant the request to withdraw? Will Harlan or Sarah be here? Harlan?
Yes, thank you, Chairman. What New Rochelle filed was incomplete, so staff sent a data request to the company after giving them approximately 4 months to respond, which they did not respond to. The company now has requested to withdraw their application. Staff would support that withdrawal.
Thank you, and I understand there's no one from New Rochelle to chat with us this morning. Or is there?
I'm not aware of anybody.
All right, thank you. So the question is, shall the commission grant the request to withdraw? Is there a motion?
I have a question first, just a clarification. Under telecommunications, what would this motion do to items under number 2 and number 3 under telecommunications that also deal with New Rochelle telephone.
Those interconnection agreements will then be disapproved by the commission.
In separate action after this?
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
I will move then that the commission grant the request to withdraw.
I'll second.
Concur.
The item then on our main agenda, TC05-052, along with a number of other ones, we have a motion, first of all, question before us, rather, that the commission deny the certificate, the COA for New Rochelle Telephone Corp. Does staff have anything to add on this item?
No, they have withdrawn rather than have a denial on the record. So why they, once they saw the agenda that it was deny, then they filed their request to withdraw.
Thank you, Mr. Best. Is there a motion then to deny the COA? Oh, that's right. That's right. Thank you, Harlan. In the matter of approving of the agreements in TC05-024 and TC05-033 applies to New Rochelle, those should be withdrawn as well. Number three, in the matter of approving amendments to the agreements TC05-038 and TC05-039, those apply to New Rochelle as well and are withdrawn. And item number four.
Commissioner Hansen.
Excuse me.
If staff may, I guess staff still takes the position that the interconnection agreements should be denied, no matter if, because they were filed prematurely before the application was filed, and just because the application has been withdrawn, we would still like to deny the interconnection agreements and the amendments to the interconnection agreements.
And so
because they have no certificate in place and have no plans on filing one anytime soon again.
Mr. Chairman, I would make the motion that the commission deny the agreements in TC05024, TC05033, and then in a separate motion, I would move that the commission deny the amendments to the agreements in TC05038 and TC05039.
Second.
And I concur.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Graff. Item number four, in the matter of approving amendments to the agreements in TC05-088 and TC05-089. Question before the commission is, shall the commission approve the amendments to the agreements? Ms. Graff.
Thank you, Chairman Hansen. These, unlike the past dockets, amendments to the agreements have been properly filed. No discriminatory language was contained within, and no comments were filed during the 20-day time period. So staff would recommend approval of the following agreements.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Is there a motion?
I'll move that the commission approve the amendments to the agreements.
I second.
And I will concur. Item number five, in the matter of establishing switched access revenue requirements in TC05-083, TC05-087, TC05-090, TC05-091, TC05-092, TC05-093, TC05-094, TC05-095, TC05-097, TC05-098, and TC05-099. The question before the commission is, today shall a commission assess a filing fee not to exceed $100,000 with an initial deposit of $1,000 in each of the, with each of the dockets above. And presenting information this morning.
I'll handle that, Mr. Chairman.
Hi.
This is Heather Forty on behalf of Commission staff. What we're requesting today is that each of these switched access dockets that the Commission assess a filing fee for our actual costs, which would be the time for the analysts and attorneys involved in reviewing these dockets. We would like that the filing fee assessed not exceed $100,000 and that the initial deposit from each of the companies be $1,000. And, again, this is just for our actual time, the cost of our time, so they will not be billed anything over that. And it's usually not anywhere close to $100,000.
Thank you very much, Heather. Is there anyone else to make any presentation? Are there any questions by any of the commissioners?
This $1,000 deposit follows recent commission precedent?
Yes, it does.
Any further questions? If not, is there a motion? I will move that the commission assess a filing fee not to exceed $100,000 with an initial deposit of $1,000 in each of the dockets before us.
I will second.
Concur.
Item number 6, TC05-096, in the matter of the establishment of switch access rates for the Local Exchange Carriers Association. Questions before the commission. Shall the commission assess filing fee not to exceed $100,000 with an initial deposit of $1,000? And secondly, pursuant to SDCL 4931-12-4, shall the commission suspend the operation of the tariff for 120 days beyond the proposed effective date of the rate? Mr. Best?
And I will take that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Karen Kramer from Commission staff. As to the first question, that would be the same as the ones prior to this of a $1,000 initial deposit. As to the second question, what the proposed tariff would do is implement a rate that's based on an element which includes forecasted minutes. That has not been approved or denied by the commission yet. That is in another docket, TC05-073. So staff is requesting that this be suspended until TC05-073, a determination is made in that manner. I don't know if Mr. Ryder had any comment on this. It would be one of Ms. Rogers' cases, and I don't know if that's why you were stuck around. Okay.
Mr. Ryder.
Mr. Chair, members of the commission, just a couple thoughts to follow up what Ms. Kramer was sharing with you. And Ms. Rogers has helped me with this particularly. Every year, LECA files its switched access intrastate cost study pursuant to ARSD 20:10:27:08, which is a rule of this PUC. So every year, LECA files that cost study. This is an aggregate, I think as Ms. Kramer had indicated, of all the individual LECs revenue requirements divided by the consolidated minutes of all the companies. This results in the LECA switched access rate. Docket 05-096 is the LECA cost study filing, filed June 29, 2005, with new rates. For the past few years, LECA has filed the new rates every year, then gives notice to the IXCs that the new rates will go into effect within 30 days, even though the commission's not yet approved the rates. This file and use procedure is authorized and allowed under 49-31-12.5, and particularly subsection 1. So that's the procedure that this is the procedure which you have used in years past, the LECA has used in years past. Now, commission staff has recommended apparently suspension of this new filing, this new rate for 120 days. And as Ms. Kramer indicated, it's apparently because of the LECA waiver of rules docket that has been filed. And in that separate docket, LECA is asking the commission to allow LECA and the LECs to use projected minutes of use rather than historical test year minutes of use. The current cost studies filed the end of June are based on projected minutes of use. So those cost studies that I've referenced above are based upon those projected minutes of use, and if the waiver is not granted to in the waiver of rules docket, the other docket, all of these cost studies, including the LECAs, will have to be redone. It appears to us that the only way the LECs can receive their revenue requirement is if the new rates go into effect. And if the rates are determined in the waiver of rules docket by the commission to be incorrect, STCL 49-31-12.4 parent 5, subpart 5, allows the, or not only allows, but requires LECA to refund overcharges to the IXCs plus interest, so no one would be harmed by implementation of the rates. And because no one would be harmed by implementation of the rates, we would ask that the tariff not be suspended for 120 days beyond the proposed effective date. Thank you.
Ms. Kramer.
Thank you. Staff did consider that going into effect and then allowing them to refund with interest. But we anticipate 073 to be determined in the relatively near future, and we just thought rather than the administrative headache of tracking it, and then if it's 73 is denied, then having to go in and redo everything, we just thought this was the cleanest way for the companies to take care of it, because, like I said, we do anticipate 073 to be handled relatively quickly.
In the event that it's not handled quickly, do you have any concern with the way in which Mr. Ryder has suggested handling?
You mean allow it to go into effect and then refund it? No, that would be fine.
Okay. Are there any other questions by the commissioners?
And I would say I don't know that she has anything else to add, but Marlene Bennett is on the line.
From the Martin Group?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm still on the line. At this time, Chairman, I have nothing to add.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Bob. What is the commission's...
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I think staff may have some additional comments.
Keith.
This is Keith Singer, staff analyst. I'm the analyst assigned to TC05073, which is the waiver request, which LECA is asking to use projected minutes of use. That essentially all what LECA is asking today by requesting that the rates go into effect today is that the commission would be approving for rates that are to go into effect that are not in compliance with the commission rules at this point. LECA has asked for that waiver. We are working on that docket, and if the commission approve that request today, we would have interim rates that are not in compliance with the commission rules. Staff has some very strong feelings regarding the use of projected minutes, and we would just request that you grant the 120-day extension.
Thank you very much, Mr. Singer. Anyone further? Any further questions?
I don't have a further question, but I do have a question for our general counsel, and it's be something that would be off the record. So if you want me to move to – I would like to move.
Go ahead and make the motion.
I would move that we go into executive session.
And we will the commissioners will exit as opposed to trying to have everyone else exit, and we'll be back in about 10 minutes, 15 minutes.
I'm hoping 5 or less.
All right, great.
Closer to or less.
Slightly under the 5 minutes. However, there isn't anything materially different that we'll be talking about immediately here. We are returning on item TC05-096. And is there a motion?
I would move the commission assess a filing fee not to exceed $100,000 with an initial deposit of $1,000 and pursuant to SDCL 4931.12.4 that the commission suspend the operation of the tariff for 120 days beyond the proposed effective date of the rate.
Second.
And I concur. Administration, review of implementation of FCC requirements for 811. Sarah, Ms. Reff.
Thank you, Chairman Hansen. As you probably well know, on March 14th of 2005, the FCC instituted an order requiring the use of 811 for one-call notification systems. They
In that order, they established a two-year time frame to have the states actually implement the actual 811 number. Staff would, after hearing comments from industry and from the South Dakota One Call Notification Board, just thought it would be pertinent to receive comments from industry regarding the implementation so that we can facilitate the process and maybe get it on board sooner rather than later.
Thank you, Sarah. I believe Mr. Smith drew up a potential motion, and Rolaine, did you have an opportunity to look at that? Okay. The motion then is, unless there are any questions by commissioners, I move that the commission open a docket to solicit comment concerning issues related to implementation in the state of South Dakota of 811 as the universal one-call number, and particularly whether interested parties, including the One Call Board and carriers, believe that new rules are needed or whether the commission should simply address issues involving particular carriers as they arise.
I will second.
Then we have one item left on our agenda, and that is the on the top of the addendum, Consumer Issues, CE05-001. In the matter of the complaint filed by Larry Fliss of Hendricks, Minnesota, against Otter Tail Power Company regarding voltage fluctuation.
Chairman Hanson, I think there's people on the phone from Otter Tail.
Thank you very much. A third request for a 20-day extension to respond to the complaint was filed by Otter Tail on July 22nd. Question is, shall the commission grant the request? Otter Tail?
Mr. Chairman, Kevin Koba with Otter Tail Power. I'd like to defer to Ron Spangler, who can give you a brief summary as to the reason for the request. He's still on the phone. I hope he is.
Thank you, Kevin.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioners, this is Ron Spangler with Otter Tail Power Company. As the Commission is aware, the complaint filed by Mr. Fliss is the result of voltage fluctuations that he's been receiving from the operation of some irrigation equipment at the Hendricks Golf Course, which is a Minnesota customer. And even though Mr. Fliss has a Minnesota address, I believe he is on the South Dakota side of the border, so he is a South Dakota customer. Since this was a issue that involved two state commissions, Otter Tail felt that we should seek the opinion of the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission Consumer Affairs Office for the appropriate next steps for us to take, because we believe this was a sensitive issue for all parties involved, and we wanted to make sure we were taking those appropriate steps. After some exchange of information, the Minnesota Commission staff initiated a report to us which contained a recommendation of the steps that we should take, and due to some information that we had provided to the Minnesota Commission staff, the report contained some inconsistencies with respect to the distribution system in the Hendricks area and also the golf course. In order for us to provide some correct information and also additional information, we put together and met with the representatives from Otter Tail, put together and met with the commission staff in Minnesota on Wednesday, July 20th, to discuss the issue. Shortly after that meeting, we started to put together a summary with respect to the items discussed in that meeting, which included the situation at the golf course, the distribution system at Hendricks. It also included some our motor starting policy and portions of our general rules and regulations that we believe would help them in making a decision in this situation, and the load growth in the area, and also some correspondence that we've had with the golf course and Mr. Fliss. And then on July 22nd, we filed a request to for an extension to respond to Mr. Fliss's complaint, so that we could allow the Minnesota staff time to review the summary that we had put together and possibly put together a revised recommendation. That summary was sent to the Minnesota Commission staff by electronic mail and overnight mail on the 25th of July of this year. and a copy was sent to the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission staff, as well as a copy of the initial report that was issued by the Minnesota Commission engineer on July 8th. And at this point, we believe that it's appropriate for us to wait for the revised recommendation that the commission staff in Minnesota is going to issue. And I did have a brief conversation with the engineer in Minnesota, and he did state that he was working on a draft, and he should have that recommendation out to us in the next few days. We did also visit with Mr. Fliss last week. Our service representative contacted him, and it's my understanding that Mr. Fliss understands the situation. He understood that it could take some time to have a resolution to this, and with any reasonable customer or any reasonable person, he would like to have a resolution as soon as possible, and I believe we would as well. But as I said before, we believe it's appropriate for us to wait for that revised recommendation from the Minnesota Commission, and we respectfully request that you grant our 20-day extension that we have requested. And I would be available for any questions that you might have at this time.
Thank you, Ron. Staff, do you have anything to add?
I agree. This is quite a complicated issue involving both commissions. I was contacted by the engineer from the Minnesota Commissions, and the indications that I have, although maybe Mr. Spangler spoke to him since then, are that this might go on for quite some time over there. Meanwhile, this customer, Mr. Fliss, though he has been very patient and very reasonable about it, I think that I would recommend that we move forward and get some sort of answer so we can continue with our process rather than waiting for the hand to play out in Minnesota. I have no idea how long that will take.
Thank you, Mr. Melhoff. Are there any questions by the commissioners?
This is Commissioner Johnson. I do have a question for Mr. Spangler. You know, given what Mr. Melhoff has said, I mean, I guess I do have real concerns about, you know, Mr. Fliss sort of being in a holding pattern. Do you have any response to the slightly different impressions that you and Mr. Melhoff have given me about how long it's going to take for Minnesota to get lined up with their efforts?
I guess after my conversation with the engineer at the Minnesota Commission, it sounded like he was ready to release his recommendation possibly even today. I've been away from my desk, so I haven't been able to see that he had emailed me anything, but it sounded like it was going to be within the next few days. You know, that would be their recommendation. It may not necessarily be a resolution to this situation, which I would tend to agree with Mr. Melhoff that it may take a little bit more time than just next week. We may not have an answer next week.
Chairman Hansen, if I may suggest or say something too, all the staff is requesting is that they file an answer to the 20-day. I mean, they've been requesting a 20-day extension from filing a response to the complaint. Staff is merely requesting that a 20-day extension not be granted and that they just file an answer to the complaint. We know that this by no means is going to resolve it, but it's just going to at least get the ball rolling.
Thank you. John, do you have a question?
I do, and maybe it's Mr. Spangler or maybe Sarah or Jim. Do they need this 20-day extension in order to avoid defaulting? And with sort of our verbal instructions here today that, okay, we'll grant you this one last one, but then let's get an answer filed and move on.
I guess I would have to look at the date of the last order from the last commission meeting because you granted a 20-day extension at the last commission meeting. I'd have to look at that and count the days out from there.
Any further questions?
Well, it's always dangerous to do math on the fly. On July 6, 2005, Otter Tail Reef filed a second request for a 20-day request. Is that
I'm trying to remember. Is that the one that's before us, or is it the third request that's before us? So if we grant this second one, then we're right on top of the end of the period. Is that right?
That would be the day of the filing.
But they filed it on the 6th, and the commission meeting was, what, the 12th?
12th. So we're pretty close to it. You know, Mr. Spangler, I think you kind of see that the commission would like a response on this. I mean, how quickly do you think it'd take you to respond to the complaint?
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner Saar, I'm actually leaving for vacation tomorrow, so I would have to work with our attorney to have him help us draft a response. But I would suspect that we could probably have something by the middle of next week.
Thank you. Are there any further questions? If not, is there a motion?
Mr. Spangler, and not that I am absolutely banking this on your vacation, but since you threw that out there, when are you coming back?
I'm actually going to be gone all of next week. I could try to grab our attorney yet today. I can't guarantee anything, but depending upon the type of, you know, if we can just you would be open to our response being that we would like to wait for the Minnesota Commission recommendation. Because I think from our perspective, we would like to wait for that recommendation so we can review it and determine if that's the appropriate steps as far as from a business perspective that we should take.
Mr. Chairman, I have a clarification question. Are these 20-day extensions, are those calendar days or working days? Do either of our general counsel
know? They'd be calendar days.
Thank you.
John, did you have a recommendation? Or is
there... Well, I think just my recommendation would be to grant them the additional 20-day extension, but with instructions to Otter Tail that then within this extension period, that unless the matter is resolved, that an answer be filed. I mean, that doesn't decide the case. It's just we'd file an answer and we'd move along as we normally do.
I think there's very good points from staff that we need to get done with this and that they have to file then within the 20-day period. Is that 20 days, within 20 days after this extension, they would have to file. As it's not a full 20-day extension. They've got 19 days and 23 hours to file.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
This is Ron Spangler again. So we would have 20 days from the 25th of July. Is that correct? I believe that's when I did my math on the fly. I think that's the where the deadline was for us to then ask the answer.
That's a lot of heads are nodding here, and so that's what I'm going to say, yes, from the 25th.
Is it from the date of the order that we sign it, or is it going to be from the – or how are we going to draft this, John? I mean, and to a certain extent, I mean, it's something that I hate to say this, but counting days is always gets complicated, and I hate to throw this out. It is what it is, and so depending on how we sign it in the order – I mean, I don't know if I really want to be committing to a certain date because you're the one who has to draft it. So you need to tell us how you're going to draft this thing.
How about this? I don't know if you have a calendar on your computer, if anyone in the room has a calendar. Well, I would be looking at a day that is not a Saturday or Sunday. What I'm going to suggest is have it due on or before August 10th because I happen to know that's not a Sunday.
And that's in the middle of the week, so that's a safe spot.
I know that because my daughter's birthday is August 7th, and that's on Sunday.
Well, with that in mind and with the obvious commission's urging for Otter Tail to move as quickly as possible to getting an answer filed and thing resolved, then I would move that we grant the request until August 10th.
Second.
I would concur.
Thank you. That concludes the agenda business. We have announcements. Next regularly scheduled commission meeting will be held August 9th, 2005 at 10:30 in room 412 in Pierre, South Dakota. We also have meetings scheduled for September 13th and 27th. The hearing on docket EL04-016 has been continued or canceled for folks like me who are laymen. That was scheduled for August 2nd and continuing through August 3rd through the 5th. The FCC Commissioner John Adelstein will be joining the Commission on its broadband road trip August 23 through 25. And a hearing on docket CT05-001 has been scheduled to begin at 10 a.m. August 30th and continue through August 31st in room 412 in the state capitol. South Dakota PUC and the U.S. Department of Energy are partnering together to host a regional wind conference September 11th through the 13th at the Swiftel Center in Brookings, South Dakota. Any further announcements? Seeing none. Meeting is adjourned. Thank you.